Hello and welcome back to the Conspiracy Theory Test again. I'm Yvan.
And I'm Karen.
And you're very welcome back to another episode, which is now breaking a record for having two out on time in a row.
Who do we think we are?
2022 is going to be a very professional, well put together year. Is okay, it 2022?
It is 2022, okay. Apparently.
Maybe it won't be.
Maybe it won't be. Maybe it will be. We don't know. Let's not make too many gross assumptions.
No, let's not make any promises. Problems. That was a Freudian slip.
You know, you won't see us again for 6 months.
Yeah. We like to keep you on your toes.
Saw them again.
What's the crack house, Karen?
Karen is good. Yeah, thank you very much for asking. I'm having a grand old week, despite the world being on fire, still. It was nice being back last week, and thanks so much for tuning in if you did, and for listening to the episode, and a few of you shared it on Instagram and stuff. So thank you very much. All support is very much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks everyone who not only was so patient, but picked back up with us. And a few messages there on Instagram from people saying they're very excited to get stuck back in. So delighted with that.
Yeah.
Because of the clean slate kind of thing, we don't have much housekeeping. The polls will start again this week for last week's episode. So that'll be good. We can go head to head again and start a ridiculous level of competitiveness that'll pick back up from next week.
Absolutely.
And the only other bit is that last week, little correction, I announced that the last bingo word would be in it, but I got too damn excited my story and forgot all about it. So I'm announcing this week, it's actually written into my story, or Karen's possibly. So it'll definitely be the last word this week.
Okay. Do you want me to remind you? We both just forgot. Like, we both forgot. Like, yeah.
To the point I was going to actually edit one in afterwards. It was too much work. Too much wizardry. Imagine. Needed. But this Absolutely. Week is the week. So listen keenly and get in touch if you hear us.
Fantastic.
So Karen, with all the housekeeping done, you're kicking us off.
I am kicking us off. I'm actually just going to preface this episode by saying that I'd like to dedicate it to my parents, who yesterday celebrated their 45th wedding anniversary and have never listened to this podcast because they don't know how podcasts work.
They're just going to have to take your word that it's dedicated to them.
Yeah, I'm sure if Stephen and Andrea eventually listen to this, they can tell them and play it for them.
Oh, well done, guys.
Yeah, congrats on an outstanding 45 years together.
45, that's a good chunk, isn't it?
Yeah, that's like two life sentences.
They'd have gotten less for murder.
Which they have said to each other many, many times. I would have got less for killing you. True love.
Right, this one's for them.
This one's for them. And actually, I suppose because they have a daughter called Karen, it's only fitting that I did one on a lady called Karen Silkwood. Have you heard about this?
No, sounds great though.
Okay, so this sources for this come from my conspiracy theories books by Jamie King, time.com, history.com, britannica.com, wikipedia.com, and reddit.com. And Yvan, as usual, I am once again combining my love of true crime and conspiracy theories. So let's grab the snorkels and dive right in. So Karen Silkwood died under mysterious circumstances in 1974. So she worked at the Kerr McGee processing plant in Oklahoma and was known as an activist and a unionist. So basically, the Kerr McGee processing plant at the time did like radioactive parts and things like that. So on the day she died, Silkwood was allegedly on her way to the New York Times to deliver a folder full of damning evidence to a union rep as well as a New York Times reporter. And when her car was involved in a single car collision. So to this day, nobody knows how that car crash came about. So there's a few theories as to why Silkwood passed away. So she was a campaigner, as I said, and her campaign as an activist focused on some major health and safety issues in corporate practice. And of course, she kind of alleged or stated that at the time, the factory that she worked in, Kerr McGee, basically didn't take into account the safety of their employees, like Silkwood herself. However, had Silkwood not have died in the crash, she was likely to contract cancer and pass away that way. Such was the high level of radiation found in her body, which I'm going to ask you to keep in mind as I get into the story a little bit more.
Radioactive pin in that, perfect.
A radioactive pin indeed. So tests that she took from November 1974 showed that Silkwood had levels of plutonium contamination that didn't add up to those of her co-workers. So her co-workers exhibited much lower levels of radiation exposure, as did Silkwood's housemate and boyfriend. So there's been a suggestion that Kerr McGee had actually been intentionally poisoning Karen in an attempt to silence her.
Oh, what a brutal way to silence someone.
Yeah, absolutely. Just so, like, so brutal. So I'll give you a bit a background into this, right? So this is kind of taken largely from Wikipedia. So she was joined, she started working for the company in 1972, and then she joined the local oil, chemical and atomic workers union and took part in a strike at the plant. After the strike, she was elected to the union's bargaining committee and was the first woman to achieve that position at Kerr McGee. So girl boss, the OG, like, you kind of have to think of her as the OG girl boss and whistleblower, basically.
Yeah,
pretty much. So she was assigned to investigate health and safety issues. And again, she discovered then, once she was assigned to do this, she discovered what she believed to be numerous violations of health regulations, which included exposure of workers to contamination, faulty respiratory equipment, and improper storage samples. So she believes that the lack of sufficient shower facilities could increase the risk of employee contamination, which, given her levels of contamination, is probably completely true and accurate.
So she thought a lot could be prevented if people could just literally wash it off before they left.
Pretty much, yeah, absolutely.
That's so annoying, because it would have been so simple.
But that's, like, I think this is his thing, though, as well. Like, that's 1974. I'm sure there's still things now, like, you could say for, like, corporate America, and not just corporate America, but corporate facilities. Or, like, if you look at Amazon and stuff like that nowadays, you still hear, like, ridiculous work practices going on there.
Yeah, very true. Very true. It's not gotten much better.
Exactly. So on the 5th of November, then, in 1974, Silkwood herself performed a self-check, and she found that her body contained almost 400 times the legal limit for plutonium contamination.
Jesus. It's a lot of plutonium in one body.
Absolutely. Like, and again, she was, like, if you look at photos of her, and so she seems to be kind of quite slight and slim build as well. So the fact that she had that much within her system is, like, baffling. So she was decontaminated at the plant on that day, and then she was sent home with a testing kit to collect urine and feces for further analysis. And again, although there was plutonium on the inner portions of the glove, which she'd been using, the gloves didn't have any holes. So that suggests that the contamination had not come from inside the glove box, but from some other source. So, and as I said at the start, on the night that she died, she did have allegedly a folder full of evidence to expose the company. There was no folder ever found at the scene of the car crash.
Someone got in and out.
In and out. But who, like, this is the thing, though. Who got in? Right? Who got in is what I want to know.
Plant owners is my guess.
Perhaps. I reckon that the police were in on it as well. So because the trooper at the scene then, so the state trooper that found her at the scene, he remembers that he found one or two tablets of this sedative methaqualone, which is known as Quaaludes, which were pretty big back in the 70s and 80s. And he said he remembers finding cannabis. So then that led to the police report indicating that she fell asleep at the wheel. Right? The coroner then, when they performed the autopsy, found about 0.35 milligrams of methaqualone per 100 milliliters of blood at the time of her death. And that's basically almost twice the recommended dosage for inducing drowsiness.
Okay. Do you think...
But I don't know. There's been nothing to suggest that she was a cannabis or a Quaalude user.
You think she was dosed once they got to her?
I think so. Or I think she was dosed before she left somewhere. I don't know. It's a tricky one. It is a tricky one.
And the two can exist, of course.
Yeah.
Both could be true. She could have imbibed, but actually could have still been crashed into. She could have been fine, you know, otherwise.
Interesting that you said crashed into. Because the whole police report was like she fell asleep on behind the wheel because she was dosed up, and then the car veered off-road, crashed. She died. Right, but an accident investigator found skid marks and a suspicious dent in her Honda's rear bumper that would indicate a second car had forced Silkwood off the road.
Oh, and if it came from behind, how easy to keep driving.
Exactly. So, and as we said, like she found some like unsafe work practices, right? But on Reddit, somebody, and this is like from 2 years old, not only did she potentially or definitely find unsafe work practices, somebody on Reddit believes that she, like, so not only was she about to whistleblow about faulty plutonium rods in her company, she was actually murdered for accidentally uncovering a covert plot to give plutonium to Israel.
Oh, no, that's way bigger.
Right? Because I was thinking that as well. If she, right? So if you think about it, if she's going to, like, why would you kill someone for outing your faulty work practices? Like, why go straight to murdering them?
That's true. That can be silenced much quicker or easier.
That's what I mean. Could you not intimidate her first?
Or bribe. I can't imagine she was being paid a whole ton in the first place.
That's what I mean. Like, to me, like, I would, like, I, to me, normally what you see, like, you know, maybe this is conjecture, like you see it in movies and TV shows, but they do intimidate a person first, or they offer them money, or they offer them money and then they intimidate them. But again, nothing that I've read online suggests that she was ever confronted before this. She was ever told to stand down before this. She was intimidated. She was offered money, nothing. So why go straight for the kill?
And again, because like we were saying, it would be so easy to prevent once it's okay. So it's brought to the union and the union do an audit and they find us, you need to install showers. Needing to install showers doesn't equate to shutting down the plant.
And also just, I think that she was also alleging that the stuff that they were making, the plutonium rods they were making, were faulty and shabby. So again, though, like, it was just, I was kind of like, oh, this kind of sounds like a run of the mill. She knew too much. But like, genuine, now I'm looking at it, like, if you take the Israeli kind of element into it, like, Jesus, that's big. So basically, yeah. So somebody on the original poster on Reddit was My Morning Jacket. And they said, I believe that she was killed for not just uncovering faulty fuel rods and fraud, but for uncovering a covert mission by the CIA, Mossad, and some Iranians to give plutonium to Israel in order to help them obtain nuclear bombs, because allegedly 40 pounds of weapons grade plutonium went missing and nobody said anything.
Okay, I was wondering why and how much. 40 pounds of us, did you say?
40 pounds of like weapons grade plutonium must have went missing from the factory and nobody said a thing.
That's a lot of plutonium to lose. That's not a little speck on your boot.
That's the thing, and it's not absolutely not. And like, there was so much as well, basically, that, you know, that there was plutonium essentially found all over her apartment, like all over,
just from her lolling about the place.
Yeah,
it was
absolutely.
Just on her. Not that she stole it, just to clarify, was it?
No, not at all. As in, like, no, it was on surfaces, stuff like that. Like, basically, that some doctor said, a doctor who testified in the case essentially said that Silkwood had been exposed to so much radiation poisoning that cancer was essentially guaranteed. And she was like the only one in the factory that had that much exposure.
Okay. So the two go hand in hand. How do they go hand in hand though? So they were trying to poison her and that was taking too long, so they just bumped her off the road.
Yeah, because apparently plutonium got into her system, like into her lungs and her digestive tract.
That must have been absolutely agonizing.
Like, it was found in her kitchen. This is from the Time article. It was found in her kitchen, her bathroom, and in a bologna and cheese sandwich in her refrigerator.
Oh, God.
Now, I don't know about you, Van, but I don't like putting radiation on my sandwiches. Like, essentially then as well, like, it's just one of those things, like, it's just, to me, it's so bizarre. And of course, the defense attorney at the time said that they were like, basically tried to say that she was purposely contaminating herself to try and cover up her drug habit.
Or could she have been purposely contaminating herself to show the damage? Like, she was willing to kind of sacrifice herself to show the damage, the exposure on other
workers.
I
don't think she was willing to expose herself that much. So, like, again, you're not going to willingly put it into a sandwich.
It could You're be just delicious. Not. You don't know.
Do you want to try it? You know what? You try it.
I'll give it a go.
Between now and next week's episode, and you let me know.
I'll see if I'm here for next week's episode.
Absolutely. So I think essentially, basically, that I think she was forced off the road. And I think that the reason being was that she had not only unsafe work practices, uncovered all that kind of stuff, that she had uncovered something bigger. Maybe it wasn't like directly to the Iranians or Israelis or whatever, but I think she uncovered something that she didn't mean to, and in the eyes of Kerr McGee, shouldn't have found out about at all.
And do we believe it's the Iranians and the Israelis because of the time that it occurred in? There's nothing else. There's no other tie. Just that it's...
just because of the time, basically. Her father then as well sued Kerr McGee, and the company basically settled for legal fees of $1.3 million. The company settled for $1.3 million at the time, minus legal fees. And in 1979, the plant closed, basically, because Westinghouse, which had been buying its fuel rods from Kerr McGee, complained about their poor quality and refused to renew its contract. So she was right in that respect.
Right the whole time, probably about everything, if she was right about that.
Absolutely. And of course, she was kind of like, the defense attorneys tried to demean her, and for some reason was just like, she was also kinky. Which has that got to do with anything?
The defense stuff is always mad. This character assassination.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the way like big corporate companies hate in America, they just hate unions for whatever reason.
Yeah. They really make them enemy number one.
Yeah, it's just so. Yeah, absolutely. It's just so bad. So I feel, and also this was a big deal. And in 1983, Silkwood, the movie, was made. And Meryl Streep played Karen Silkwood.
I was trying to remember who played her.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to attribute Karen Silkwood would be one of the OG, if not the OG, whistleblowers.
Yeah. Appreciation, regardless of what happened, appreciation to her, because
absolutely, given that this week is International Women's Week coming up.
Oh yeah, that's a good shout. Okay, good.
We must recognize and celebrate women. So yeah, we recognize and celebrate Karen Silkwood's life. But I would love to know why would you, you know, I'd love to know where's, and that folder was never found. Who has the folder?
Where is it? I would say destroyed instantly.
Do you reckon the police were in on it? Like that the trooper nicked the folder? Or no, I'd say whoever ran into it probably took the folder and then ran.
I think police did, because I think it could have... I don't think it even has to go as high as the smuggled plutonium. I think it could be the police taking it, because the police could be in on it with the plant. Because how much sway did the plant have in that town? How much employment was it bringing in? How much money?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. So there you go. That's the story of the mysterious death of Karen Silkwood.
Sad, but like, what an inspiring story. What a woman. She was absolutely a proper grassroots activist.
Absolutely. Really, really got like a bee in their bonnet, like a thorn in their side the entire time.
You need her now, is what you need.
There you go. She gives some credibility back to the name Karen. I certainly don't, but she does.
Yeah, this is justice for all Karens.
Okay, not all of them. There is some reasoning behind this, like the fact that it's become a bit of a meme thing. But justice for Karen Silkwood is what I say.
Yeah, her, you, and another Karen I know are the least Karens I know.
Thank you. It's just a name. It's not a lifestyle.
No. It's not a choice. You were born this way.
born this way, exactly. And it's funny, my namesake is... I think I've told you this before. I'm named after a character from the old UK soap, Brookside. Have I told you
Brookside,
that?
Really?
Yeah, Brookside, yeah. My mom and dad were betting to Brookside. Karen Grant, I think, was her name. I think my dad had a bit of a thing for the actress up later. I'm not going to lie.
I didn't know that at all. What a namesake. At least you don't have much to live up to, sorry. It's not went on to do great things.
I mean, she was the daughter of Bobby and Sheila Grant, the sister of Damon and Claire Grant, and the half sister of Barry Grant. Yeah, they were so that's who I'm named after.
That's so funny.
Back to the day. Yeah.
Is everyone named after someone? I'm named after your one off the Leaving Cert.
You are named after a Van Boland, are you?
I am.
Gas. That is gas. She was fairly class too. She was like mates with Mary McAleese.
I liked her stuff. It was nice.
Pretty good. Yeah.
that's what happens when you have older siblings and your parents can't do anything but read books.
Yeah. Oh, parents, who'd have them?
Yeah, who'd have them willingly?
So what's your buy-in with this theory then?
I'm on your side. I don't know if it even, it's not that I don't believe the plutonium smuggling, but I don't think it needs to go that high. I think the stakes were high enough already.
Yeah.
Because she was exposing so much. I know I'm flip-flopping now from saying that they could have done so much easily to prevent the health and safety stuff.
Yeah.
But they were probably at the point where her evidence would get it shut down.
Yeah. And the fact that they were like shut down kind of nearly a year after her death, because I think, some articles say the plant was shut down in 79, but it was decommissioned in 76 for sure. So obviously they were cutting corners as well. Like if their products weren't high quality, then neither were their work practices.
That makes it even sadder that it was inevitably going to get caught out if they ran her off the road or were poisoning her. Then yeah. It was futile anyway. They were going to get caught out.
Absolutely, yeah.
What about you? Where are you lying on us?
I would like to think that it was a big, big thing. That she cracked something huge and they really didn't want her to know about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely more romantic anyway.
And I fully believe that somebody did run her off the side of the road, took the folder and scarpered, and that they were probably hired by Karen McGee. But that's never been proven. Like Karen McGee didn't even admit liability. Like they couldn't prove liability.
At all. They just distanced themselves completely.
Yeah. Maybe they would have been able to prove liability if she had lived and then developed cancer. Like.
Yeah. Yeah. And she, wait, where was she going again?
She was on her way to like meet either a union rep. Again, some articles say union rep / federal agent and a New York Times reporter. She'd been in touch with a New York Times reporter before that, and he was interested in the story, like, so. And apparently there was company papers and stuff in the folder.
I'd be interested to see, obviously it's all smoke and mirrors now, but I'd be so interested to see the any interactions that the union rep had with her in the lead up. I wonder if she ever alluded to being scared for her life, or if she had any other near misses, like say was she mugged in the days leading up, or did anyone attempt an attack?
Well, somebody must have got into her apartment as well. If you like, who puts radiation in a sandwich? You know what I mean?
Oh, they were okay. I misread this. I thought it was on her so much that it was just tracking all over the apartment.
Well, they reckon that maybe the bathroom one could have been from her because she had to do a urine and a feces sample. But like, it was in the sandwich in the fridge. She hadn't eaten the sandwich yet. The sandwich in the fridge.
Oh, no. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
You know what
that
I mean?
That entire thing passed over me.
That's all right. It's Sunday morning. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard on Sunday morning.
God, yeah, that's pretty brutal. They were just following her and putting us anywhere that she might go.
Yeah.
A plutonium sandwich is a particularly gruesome death.
Absolutely.
Aside from being run off the road. But yeah, God, tough last few days. Well done to her.
Well done to her. Yeah, and happy International Women's Day to all the Karen Silkwoods out there.
Yeah, be a Karen Silkwood.
Yeah, and not the other kind.
Yeah. I'm so glad you remembered to stay on point, because mine is unfortunately testosterone fueled this week.
Men.
There's very few women. There are no women. This theory does not pass the
Bechdel test. Happy International Women's Day. Here's a thing men did.
Yeah. Luckily that I didn't do it well, so it's
really, Kel Surprise.
Had women been involved, this would have been much more successful.
Tell you now, without Hermione, Harry would have died in book one.
Just said about Hermione, really.
Just saying, he would have died in book one.
He's a side character to Hermione's story.
It's Hermione's world. We're just living in it.
Yeah. But before we move on to that was great, Karen. That was a really good theory. And I 100% am with you. To the point I actually thought, I think that theory is taken. Most people believe that. I'd be interested to find out.
We'll see. We'll see when the polls go out.
The polls will tell all. So for my theory this week, Karen, my sources are obviously Wikipedia, history.com, the Short Histories of Podcasts, and campaign.co.uk.
Okay.
And I'm talking to you this week about the escape from Alcatraz.
Ooh, this is interesting.
This is why. It's very much one gender is involved in this. So
I feel like My Favorite Murder did this a while ago.
Oh really?
Episodes. Yeah. Oh, maybe. Was there like a riot?
That's an earlier. That's the first attempt at Escape from Alcatraz.
That's the one that they did. That's the one that they did. Never mind. Go ahead.
Oh, cool. That's a less famous one. So that involves Al Capone. And that'd be a great other one. But, that's not. So perfect. I can claim to not be plagiarizing My Favorite Murder.
Not at all. But we do love them.
We do. We do. So this one instead happens later. This one happens in the 60s. And was going to give you the history of Alcatraz, but that could take a whole episode of itself. Basically, it started as a military force to defend San Francisco Bay because it was it's just an island off the coast of San Francisco Bay, a very daunting one. It had a jail on site for military members who were acting the magus. But, you know,
I condemn you to 5 years for acting the maggot.
Yeah, for absolute maggotry. It's life to life. But because it was so daunting, like the whole of San Francisco is generally covered in a thick fog from like noon onwards. It was out in really harsh conditions in the middle of the ocean. So because of that, it became more popular as a jail and expanded to taking prisoners from other military camps, and then expanded to being a prison, and a really ominous prison at that. It got the nickname The Rock.
It does look really intimidating. Like if you see photos of it and stuff, it's very like, holy shit.
Yeah, it looks, it has a haunted vibe.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard that it is haunted. It has to be.
Say it 100% has to be. Have you been?
No. I've just seen a few like kind of documentary type bits on it. Like, but I feel like I've heard that it's haunted though.
That'd be another good episode. The haunting of Alcatraz. It has to be 100%. The amount of people who must have died there over the years.
Absolutely.
And that brings us up to, so that's a slight history, but the story actually starts with four new inmates that came between 1957 and 1961. So it was head up by Frank Morris. He was sent to The Rock when he was caught for burglary a year after escaping from another prison. And then the Anglin brothers, John and Clarence, were transferred to Alcatraz after repeated attempts to escape from an Atlanta facility. And they are my favorite thing about this story. I think all true crime feels so much more whimsical and old-timey when it involves people called the something brothers.
Oh yeah. Everything's better in teams.
Yeah, there just aren't enough sibling crime gangs anymore.
No, definitely not.
That'd be another good theory, but are Harry and Marv brothers?
Nice.
And then like his other associates, Alan West was transferred to Alcatraz after an escape attempt from a Florida facility. So they're all of these have been transferred because they've attempted to escape from somewhere else. So they're all little escape artists.
Fantastic.
And they've all had a serious life of crime. Like I'd say between them, they have in the multiple hundreds of convictions. They actually all knew each other from previous incarcerations in Florida and Georgia.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's like, hey, this is my prison friend.
Yeah. I'd say the minute you get in there, you scan for a familiar face.
I haven't seen you since the last court date.
It's like your first day of school. You're just looking for your neighbour desperately.
I hope they're in the same class.
Yeah. I hope they're on the same block. And luckily they were assigned to adjacent cells in December 1961 and began then to formulate an escape plan under the leadership of Morris, who had an intimidatingly high IQ.
Oh.
Yeah, really high. And you can tell from the plan, it's so detailed and so focused. They spent 6 months on it. They spent 6 months on the first stage, rather. They spent that time widening the ventilation ducts beneath their sinks. And to do this, they used discarded saw blades that they found on the prison grounds and metal spoons.
Why was there discarded saw blades?
They would have been in the like woodwork shop and all the different kind of areas. And it sounds like it's really careless, but actually they would have been so blunt by the time they were discarded that they would have been no threat to anyone. It kind of shows more the focus of them, that they were using blunt instruments to chip away for months.
That's dedication, in fairness.
Absolutely infuriating, and it was way too arduous that way. So eventually they improvised an electric drill from the motor of a vacuum cleaner.
That, man, that is clever.
Isn't it? That's really resourceful. I think you deserve your escape after
It's
that.
some like MacGyver next level stuff there now.
Yeah, it's seriously handy. That is good. And of course, they had to conceal their work as well. They couldn't just work away at it. They concealed it with painted cardboard, covering up the holes at the ventilation duct, and they masked the noise with Morris's accordion, which he played during music hour. So that was kind of the only time they could work, was when there was music hour. I think
I'm
it
sure
was
whoever,
two.
like the prison office, is looking back on this is like, damn music error.
Yeah.
Might have been a mistake.
I'd say he felt that was a mistake the minute they whipped out an accordion.
Oh, man.
Musical instruments play a weird recurring role in this. I didn't cover it, but earlier on, one of them is accused of hitting a prison guard over the head with a trumpet.
That's but did they blow that case away?
I wouldn't read too much into it.
Hey!
Real music
We're
notes,
hit we're
John.
hitting all the right notes with this. Gas.
Once the holes were wide enough to pass through, they could access an unguarded utility corridor directly behind the cell's tier and climb up onto the vacant top level of the cell block, where they could set up a workshop. And this is when they started constructing their escape vehicles, basically. They had to use over 50 raincoats, which had been donated. So they had to stow these over time to
Okay.
construct life preservers based on a design in a magazine called Popular Mechanics.
Oh,
And
yeah.
they, yeah, again, really resourceful. Like they don't have any equipment that's actually built to make these. And they also assembled a 6 by 14 foot rubber raft, stitched by hand and sealed with the heat from the steam pipes. And paddles were improvised out of scrap wood and screws. Now, I'm going to pause at this point and say that they were building a raft, they were building life preservers. All of this could count as a nautical reference, which is the last word in our bingo game. Thank you. Thank you for meaning that I don't have to edit in sounds later.
You are so welcome.
If you've heard this, you've heard the last bingo reference, so write in and be in with a chance to co-host the podcast for an episode. And we'll have the crack. And we can pretend that's concealed carefully in us and go back to the theory as if nothing happened.
Good job. Good job.
Thank you. I really had to write that in. I had to put it in capital letters so I wouldn't forget it this time.
Insert boat here.
So the men concealed their absence from while working outside their cells by sculpting dummy heads from homemade papier-mâché, which was a mixture of soap, toothpaste, concrete dust, and toilet paper. And they even gave them a realistic appearance by using paint from the maintenance shop and covering it in hair from the barber shop floor.
That is outstanding.
Isn't this, they really had no equipment to work with, so very impressive.
So innovative.
Yeah, the thing, look, it's the mother of invention, necessity.
There you go.
And then they made bodies for themselves with towels and clothes piled under the blankets in their bunks and the dummy heads positioned on the pillows so that they looked like they were sleeping.
Okay.
And they all,
So clever.
isn't this? So that meant that they
Yeah.
could work like indefinitely into the night, really, without being detected. And that they could use this to escape on the actual night without any detection.
I'm so blown away by this.
The amount of determination alone means that they should have been allowed to just get away with it, really. A for
I know
effort.
You're a dangerous killer. They're like dangerous criminals, possibly can kill people, but we're just gonna let that slide.
Just this time. Just
because your paper mache was so good.
It really deserved a good go.
Gold stars, boys. Gold stars.
Well done, you guys. So then on the night of June 11th, 1962, with all of the preps in place, the men initiated their plan. But importantly, Wes discovered that the cement he had used to reinforce the crumbling concrete around his vent had hardened, and that narrowed the opening and stuck the grill in place. So by the time he managed to remove the grill and we re-widened the hole, the others had left without him. So he just went back to his cell and pretended nothing ever happened.
He didn't even want to go, which is anyway, stupid plan.
I only spent 6 months chiseling at this with a spoon, but whatever.
Oh, you'd be raging.
So annoyed. You'd give
them I up. Would just actually ask the guards, just let me out. Just let me out. Please.
You could go into a plea deal because you could give all the facts. You could pretend you'd been a mole the whole time.
Oh, that's genius.
Spice is the real mother of invention.
Oh, absolutely.
So from the service corridor, Morris and the Anglin brothers climbed the ventilation shaft up to the roof, and guards did hear a loud crash as they broke out, but nothing further was heard, so they didn't investigate the noise at all. And they had their gear with them the whole time and descended 50 feet to the ground by sliding through a kitchen vent pipe. And then they climbed two 12-foot barbed wire parameter fences.
That's impressive.
Isn't it? Again, so yeah. Determined. And at the northeast shoreline, near the power plant, was a blind spot in the prison's network of searchlights and gun towers. And they used this spot to their advantage. And they, again, it's got our favourite theme is going to come back up, because they inflated their raft with a concertina that they stole from another inmate.
No way!
I think music time was pretty much the only recreational thing here. So that's the only thing
I hope
could use.
I hope they were just like, that's it, we're getting rid of music time. Yeah. This is why we can't have nice things.
No more musically themed escapes. That's it.
No more Oh Susanna. No more Old Man River.
The next group just tried to float away on the piano.
They had the keys.
Oh, very good. That was the best one.
Guys, we better stop before we lose all our fans.
So at the sometime after 10 p.m. is what investigators estimated, they boarded the raft, launched it, and departed towards their objective, which was Angel Island, 2 miles to the north. Okay. And the escape was not discovered until the morning, when, this gas, a guard reached into Morris' cell to shake him awake, and the head just rolled clean off the body.
Your man's like, oh my God, what did I do?
Oh, I'm at least getting a disciplinary for beheading this.
Oh, I might get rode up for this.
Yeah, this is not going to be good. So then they discovered what happened, and multiple military and law enforcement agencies conducted an extensive air, sea and land search over the next 10 days. So a few bits of kind of shrapnel were discovered. On June 14th, a Coast Guard cutter picked up a paddle floating about 200 yards off the southern shore of Angel Island, which was their destination. So bear that in mind. And on the same day, workers on another boat found a wallet wrapped in plastic, complete with the names, addresses and photos of the Anglin's friends and relatives. But the Anglin's might not have been as smart as Morris, because they really just lost all of their evidence there. The paper trail is complete. And on June 21st, shreds of raincoat material believed to be the remnants of the raft were found on a beach not far from the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, that one's not too promising. And the following day, a prison boat picked up a deflated life jacket made from the same material, 50 yards off Alcatraz Island.
Damn.
Now, according to the final FBI reports, this is all the evidence that was found. And FBI agents surmised early that the men had drowned. They cited the fact that the individual's personal effects were the only belongings they had, and that the men would have drowned before leaving them behind. But no human remains were found. Critically.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Isn't this? You smell a rat. But even with us, the FBI investigators announced their official position that while it was theoretically possible for the men to have reached Angel Island, the odds of their having survived the turbulent currents and frigid waters of the bay were negligible.
Well, you know what? I like thin odds.
Yeah, exactly. Because that is our theory.
That is the theory, yes.
Did they actually escape?
I think so.
We hope so. We love an underdog.
I don't know if we love an underdog if they escaped and went like murdering people. Like if they just went about their day and had a nice little time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, if they really, like, we'll let them out if they promise to be good going forward.
If they started a concertina band.
Oh yeah, they could have used all their new music. Well, we don't know if they had any musical ability, but I like to believe that they were also practicing. Probably didn't have much time.
Yeah, to do anything else.
Yeah. So there's a few bits of evidence that points to their actual escape. Most damningly, no bodies were ever retrieved.
Where are the bodies?
No body, no bother.
That's my rule for TV. Whenever someone dies in TV, I'm like, did I see their body?
Yeah, I know this is going to be a twist later.
Yeah, like I know they're coming back. I am not stupid.
Yeah, don't toy with me here. So even though the FBI claimed that the odds of having survived were negligible, it's actually been proven multiple times to be doable. And there's even a yearly Escape from Alcatraz swim held to this day.
Come on.
It roughly takes most swimmers about 2 hours to complete.
They have to have.
Could have done that, I'd say. Then no proof that they weren't good swimmers. So could have done it. But here's... So even with those, this is the real evidence, right? Mm. Even though the case was officially closed in 1979, in January of 2018... CBS San Francisco published an extract of a letter addressed to the FBI that told them a different story and claimed that the criminals had been at large since the 1960s. Yeah.
Oh, I love it.
The letter says, "My name's John Anglin. I escaped from Alcatraz in June 1962 with my brother Clarence and Frank Morris. I'm 83 years old and in bad shape. I have cancer. Yes, we all made it that night, but barely."
I love a deathbed confession.
Yeah, they're the best ones. It's where you get the good stuff.
Absolutely.
The letter was sent to the San Francisco Police Department, Richmond Station, in 2013, but had been kept under wraps during a long investigation. And an FBI laboratory examined the letter for fingerprints and DNA and the handwriting, but the results were inconclusive. And his quote was, "That means yes, and it means no. It leaves everything in limbo."
Ah, come on.
It's good enough for me.
It's good enough for me.
In the letter, the writer explained that he was the last living member of the trio and that his co-conspirators had died in 2005 and 2008. So he offered a deal. If authorities announced on television that he would receive a single 1-year jail sentence in which he could have medical treatment he needed, "I will write back to let you know exactly where I am. This is no joke."
Oh, fantastic.
But presumably due to the whole "we don't negotiate with terrorists" stance, the FBI made no such announcement and instead repressed the letter.
Absolutely no crack.
Dave, yeah, play along. Just find out what's happening. You don't have to do anything. Just engage a little.
That's all any of us are asking for.
Yeah, we just want to see it out to the end. Please. If they can chip at a wall with a spoon for 6 months, you can play ball for like one little announcement.
Absolutely.
But it's not even the first piece of evidence that suggests they might have made it out in one piece.
Oh.
Robert Checkey, who was an officer with San Francisco Police, reported seeing what he described as a pristine white boat out in the bay on the night of the men's disappearance. Very ghostly, but very incriminating. It had no lights on, but appeared to have someone on the boat, shining a flashlight into the water. And police followed up on the sighting, but never found the owner of the strange boat or where it went next.
Oh.
So it seems like they might have boarded something. Maybe someone on the outside was in on us.
Yeah.
And in 2015, there was also an alleged photo that resurfaced, taken in your favorite place for escapees to go, South America.
South America strikes again.
It appears to show the two lads 13 years after their disappearance. According to facial recognition technology, the details of their faces match the escaped brothers.
Solved.
So, yeah, that's where they are. Just look in Brazil.
As per usual, solved.
And solved. The nicest last little piece is that lots of family members of the men have also reported strange experiences. It's always been talked about through the family, says David Widener, who's the nephew of John and Clarence Anglin, because he said his grandmother, who would have been their mom, received roses for several years after the escape. Boys and their mothers, they couldn't stay away.
Couldn't stay away from their mummies. Come on now.
Classic Anglin brothers, I can only
love
assume.
It. Absolutely. Seems something like they would do.
Yeah. If I know John and Clarence, which I don't.
Which I do. Totally.
Where are you at, Karen?
They have to have. I'm totally with you.
Little underdog story to end the day.
I love a little underdog story. I wonder what they did. I wonder what else they were involved in.
Yeah. There doesn't seem like...
But why wouldn't the authorities want to prove definitively one way or the other that they were, that they did or they didn't escape?
I suppose because they... Well, it would have been terrible. Because if they escaped, then it would have been such bad. Like, the big thing about Alcatraz is that it's kind of a modern day Fort Knox. So if they couldn't prove that they'd caught them, then they're proving that it's possible to escape from Alcatraz.
Yeah, I suppose. Fair enough. Well, and, you know what? It is. Yokes on you.
And it ruins us. I mean, that's... Commonly people say that it was on to decline in popularity anyway, so it's kind of on the way out, but it shut down very soon after the escape.
Interesting.
So they not only managed to escape to Brazil, they managed to get the whole damn prison shut down. Sort of.
Feckin' Egypt.
So that's two for two. That was a good week of theories. We kind of overlapped again with our underdogs.
I love an underdog story.
Let us know what you guys believe in the polls coming up. And if you heard our very well hidden final bingo word, please get
listen
in touch.
Very carefully. Yeah.
Listen, yeah, it's not got big markers around it at all, or definitely in one or the other of the stories, any band story. You can get in touch with us by messaging us on Instagram, where at Conspiracy Theory Test. You can message us on Twitter at Conspiracy Test. You could send us an email to let us know you've won bingo in the conspiracy theory test at gmail.com. And you can listen to us at any of your platforms. We're on Anchor FM, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Castbox, and all of them.
Just all of the good places to get podcasts. Any suggestions, ideas, comments are always welcome. So do let us know what you think, and if you want to get in touch, and best of luck with the bingo.
And please give us a follow and subscribe and review if possible there. Cheers.
Absolutely. Much appreciated, guys. Have a great week. Stay safe and well. Avan, I'll chat to you later.
Soon. Bye.